Page 257, Chapter 16, Epilogue, Back to Earth. I woke on the hill. The street lamps of our suburb outshone the stars. The reverberation of the clock's stroke was followed by 11 strokes more. I singled out our window. A surge of joy, of wild joy, swept me like a wave, then peace. The littleness, but the intensity of earthly events. Gone, abolished in an instant, was the hypercosmical reality, the wild fountain of creations, and all the spray of worlds. Vanished, transmuted into fantasy, and into sublime irrelevance. The littleness, but the intensity of this whole grain of rock, with its film of ocean and of air, and its discontinuous, variegated, tremulous film of life, of the shadowy hills, of the sea, vague, horizonless, of the pulsating Cepheid lighthouse, of the clanking railway trucks. My hand caressed the pleasant harshness of the heather. Vanished the hypercosmical apparition. Not such as I had dreamed must the real be, but infinitely more subtle, more dread, more excellent, and infinitely nearer home. Yet, however false the vision in detail of structure, even perhaps in its whole form, in temper, surely it was relevant. In temper, perhaps, it was even true. The real itself, surely, had impelled me to conceive that image, false in every theme and facet, yet in spirit true. The stars wanly trembled above the street lamps. Great suns, or feeble sparks in the night sky? Suns, it was vaguely rumored. Lights, at least, to steer by and to beckon the mind from the terrestrial flurry, but piercing the heart with their cold spears. Sitting there on the heather, on our planetary green, I shrank from the abyss that opened up on every side and in the future. The silent darkness, the featureless unknown, were more dread than all the terrors that imagination had mustered. Peering, the mind could see nothing more, nothing in all human experience to be grasped as certain, except uncertainty itself. Nothing but obscurity gendered by a thick haze of theories. Man's science was a mere mist of numbers, his philosophy but a fog of words. His very perception of this rocky grain and all its wonders was but a shifting and a lying apparition. Even oneself, that seeming central fact, was a mere phantom, so deceptive that the most honest of men must question his own honesty, so insubstantial that he must even doubt his very existence. And our loyalties, so self-deceiving, so misinformed and so misconceived, so savagely pursued and hate-warped. Our very loves, and those in full and generous intimacy, must be condemned as unseeing, self-regarding, and self-congratulatory. And yet, I singled out our window. We had been happy together. We had found, or we had created, our little treasure of community. This was the one rock in all the welter of experience. This, not the astronomical and hypercosmical immensity, nor even the planetary grain. This alone was the solid ground of existence. On every side was confusion, a rising storm, great waves already drenching our rock, and all around in the dark welter, faces and appealing hands half seen and vanishing. And the future? Black with the rising storm of this world's madness, though shot through with flashes of a new and violent hope, the hope of a sane, a reasonable, a happier world. Between our time and that future, what horror lay in store? Oppressors would not meekly give way. And we, too, accustomed only to security and mildness, were fit only for a kindly world, wherein none being tormented, none turns desperate. We were adapted only to fair weather, for the practice of the friendly but not too difficult, not heroical virtues in a society both secure and just. Instead, we found ourselves in an age of titanic conflict, when the relentless powers of darkness and the ruthless, because desperate powers of light were coming to grips for a death struggle in the world's torn heart, when grave choices must be made in crisis after crisis, and no simple or familiar principles were adequate. Beyond our estuary, a red growth of fire sprang from a foundry. At hand, the dark forms of the gross lent mystery to the suburb's foot-worn moor. In imagination, I saw behind our own hill's top the farther and unseen hills. I saw the plains and woods and all the fields, each with its myriads of particular blades. I saw the whole land curving down from me over the planet's shoulder. The villages were strung together on a mesh of roads, steel lines, and humming wires. Mist drops on a cobweb. Here and there a town displayed itself as an expanse of light and nebulous luminosity, sprinkled with stars. Beyond the plains, London, neon-lit, seething, was a microscope slide drawn from foul weather and crowded with noising animalcules. Animalcules. In the stars' view, no doubt, these creatures were mere vermin, yet each to itself, and sometimes one to another, was more real than all the stars. Gazing beyond London, imagination detected the dim stretch of the Channel, and then the whole of Europe, a patchwork of tillage and sleeping industrialism. Beyond popular Normandy spread Paris, with the towers of Notre Dame tipped slightly by reason of Earth's curvature. Further on, the Spanish night was ablaze with the murder of cities. Away to the left lay Germany with its forests and factories, its music, its steel helmets. In cathedral squares I seemed to see the young men ranked together in thousands, exalted, possessed, saluting the floodlit Führer. In Italy, too, land of memories and illusions, the mob's idols spellbound the young. Far leftwards again, Russia, an appreciably convex segment of our globe, snow pale in the darkness, spread out under the stars and cloud tracks. Inevitably I saw the spires of the Kremlin confronting the Red Square. There Lenin lay, victorious. Far off, at the foot of the Urals, imagination detected the ruddy plumes and smoke pall of Magnitostroy. Beyond the hills there gleamed a hint of dawn, for day, at my midnight, was already pouring westward across Asia, overtaking with its advancing front of gold and rose the tiny smoke caterpillar of the Trans-Siberian Express. To the north, the iron-hard Arctic oppressed the exiles in their camps. Far southward lay the rich valleys and plains that once cradled our species. But there I now saw railway lines ruled across the snow. In every village, Asiatic children were waking to another school day and to the legend of Lenin. South again, the Himalayas, snow-clad from waist to crest, looked over the rabble of their foothills into crowded India. I saw the dancing cotton plants and the wheat and the sacred river that bore the waters of Kemet past rice fields and crocodile shallows, past Calcutta with its shipping and its offices, down to the sea. From my midnight I looked into China. The morning sun glanced from the flooded fields and gilded the ancestral graves. The Yangtze, a gleaming, crumpled thread, rushed through its gorge. Beyond the Korean ranges and across the sea stood Fujiyama, extinct and formal. Around it a volcanic population welled and seethed in that narrow land like lava in a crater. Already it spilled over Asia a flood of armies and of trade. Imagination withdrew and turned to Africa. I saw the man-made thread of water that joins west to east, then minarets, pyramids, and the ever-waiting Sphinx. Ancient Memphis itself now echoed with the rumor of Magnitostroy. Far southward, black men slept beside the Great Lakes. Elephants trampled the crops. Farther still, where Dutch and English profit by the Negro millions, those hosts were stirred by vague dreams of freedom. Peering beyond the whole bulge of Africa, beyond cloud-spread Table Mountain, I saw the southern ocean, black with storms, and then the ice cliffs with their seals and penguins, and the high snowfields of the one unpeopled continent. Imagination faced the midnight sun across the pole and passed Erebus, vomiting hot lava down his ermine. Northward it sped over the summer sea, past New Zealand, that freer but less conscious Britain, to Australia, where clear-eyed horsemen collect their flocks. Still peering eastward from my hill, I saw the Pacific, strewn with islands, and then the Americas, where the descendants of Europe long ago mastered the descendants of Asia through priority in the use of guns and the arrogance that guns breed. Beside the farther ocean, north and south, lay the old New World, the River Plate and Rio, the New England cities, radiating center of the old new style of life and thought. New York, dark against the afternoon sun, was a cluster of tall crystals, a Stonehenge of modern megaliths. Round these, like fishes nibbling at the feet of waders, the great liners crowded. Out at sea also I saw them, and the plunging freighters foraging through the sunset, portholes and decks aglow. Stokers sweated at furnaces, lookout men in crow's nests shivered. Dance music, issuing from opened doors, was drowned by the wind. The whole planet, The whole rock grain with its busy swarms I now saw as an arena where two cosmical antagonists, two spirits, were already preparing for a critical struggle, already assuming terrestrial and local guise and coming to grips in our half-awakened minds. In city upon city, in village after village, and in innumerable lonely farmsteads, cottages, hovels, shacks, huts, in all the crevices where human creatures were intent on their little comforts and triumphs and escapes, the great struggle of our age was brewing. One antagonist appeared as the will to dare for the sake of the new, the longed-for, the reasonable and joyful world in which every man and woman may have scope to live fully and live in service of mankind. The other seemed essentially the myopic fear of the unknown, or was it more sinister? Was it the cunning will for private mastery which fomented for its own ends the archaic, reason-hating and vindictive passion of the tribe? It seemed that in the coming storm all the dearest things must be destroyed, all private happiness, all loving, all creative work in art, science, and philosophy, all intellectual scrutiny and speculative imagination, and all creative social building, all indeed that man should normally live for, seemed folly and mockery and mere self-indulgence in the presence of public calamity. But if we failed to preserve them, then would they live again? How to face such an age? How to muster courage, being capable only of homely virtues? How to do this, yet preserve the mind's integrity, never to let the struggle destroy in one's own heart what one tried to serve in the world, the spirit's integrity? Two lights for guidance. The first, our little glowing atom of community with all that it signifies. The second, the cold light of the stars, symbol of the hypercosmical reality with its crystal ecstasy. Strange that in this light, in which even the dearest love is frostily assessed, and even the possible defeat of our half-waking world is contemplated without remission of praise, the human crisis does not lose but gains significance. Strange that it seems more, not less, urgent to play some part in this struggle, this brief effort of animalcules striving to win for their race some increase of lucidity before the ultimate darkness. A note on magnitude. Immensity is not itself a good thing. A living man is worth more than a lifeless galaxy. But immensity has indirect importance through its facilitation of mental richness and diversity. Things are, of course, only large and small in relation to one another. To say that a cosmos is large is only to say that in relation to it, some of its constituents are small. To say that its career is long is merely to say that many happenings are contained within it. But though the spatial and temporal immensity of a cosmos have no intrinsic merit, they are the ground for psychical luxuriance, which we value. Physical immensity opens up the possibility of vast physical complexity, and this offers scope for complex-minded organisms. This is at any rate true of a cosmos like ours, in which mind is conditioned by the physical. The probable size of our cosmos may be very roughly conceived by means of the following analogy, adapted from one given in W. L. Lewton's The Pageant of the Stars. Let whales represent the size of our galaxy, say 100,000 light-years. This is said to be surrounded by a system of seven much smaller sub-galaxies and globular clusters all lying within a diameter of 1 million light-years. In our model, they would spread far into the Atlantic and into Europe. Other such systems would lie throughout space at average intervals represented by the distance from Wales to North America. On the same scale, the remotest galaxy visible through the great 100-inch telescope, some 500 million light-years distant, would lie 60,000 miles off, or a quarter of the distance to the Moon. The forthcoming 200-inch telescope will doubtless have a far greater range. The total extent of the cosmos would be represented in this model by a volume about 11 million miles across, or one-eighth the distance from the Earth to the Moon. The distance between the Sun and the nearest star, 4.5 light-years, would be about 13 feet. A light-year itself would be rather less than 3 feet. The average speed of stellar motion, 20 miles a second, is represented by a rate of about 4 inches in 100 years. The Earth's orbit is 1,000th of an inch in diameter. The Sun's diameter is 6 millionth of an inch. The Earth is reduced to a grain 1/20th of an inch across. There then follows a timescale 1, timescale 2, timescale 3, which have illustrations indescribable. The end of Starmaker by Olaf Stapleton. Narrated by William F. Carduff, Baltimore, Maryland. For special distribution as authorized by Act of Congress under Public Law 89-522 with the permission of the copyright holder. If you experienced any difficulty with this recording, please tie a piece of string around one of the container straps before returning it. Place the defective recording in the container, braille side down, for identification.